Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Jonathan Jones reporting. Yemen's former president Ali Abdullah Saleh has been killed, his party confirmed Monday. A video showing what appeared to be his corpse has been circulating on social media. He had reportedly been shot in the head. The 75-year-old Saleh ruled Yemen for more than three decades before he was ousted under popular and political pressure in 2012, but continued to wield power behind the scenes, forming an alliance with the Iran-backed Houthis. His death happened 2 days after the alliance appeared to have fallen apart. On Saturday, Saleh denounced the Houthi militia and suggested restoring ties with Saudi Arabia. In a victory for President Trump, the Supreme Court decided Monday to allow his latest travel ban to remain in force while the legal fight continues in the lower courts. Seven of the justices ruled in favor of the administration, while two, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, said the partial stay on the ban should continue. The court did not give a reason for its decision. The travel ban is the third one Trump has issued. It bars most travelers from eight countries: Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. Six of the eight are Muslim-majority nations. For the first time since 2011, a UN official will be visiting North Korea, which has ramped up its nuclear and ballistic missile tests this year. Undersecretary General for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman is expected to visit Pyongyang from December 5th to the 8th. This is VOA News. Governments must do far more to include the needs of young people in the global fight against HIV and AIDS, according to a new report. Despite progress in tackling the disease, it's estimated that 1,700 new HIV infections happen every day among young people around the world, and the problem is particularly acute in Africa. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The charity Centre Bale, which helped put together the policy recommendations, was co-founded by Prince Harry, who is newly engaged to American actress Meghan Markle. She has also campaigned on health issues in Africa. Earlier this year, the prince chaired a meeting in London on adolescents with HIV, titled Let Youth Lead, and called for a change in global education on the disease.
Young people, the first time they know or the first time they hear anything about HIV and AIDS is probably by the time it's too late. Whether it's in the education system here in the UK, whether it's across Africa, whether it's across the world, HIV needs to be treated exactly the same as any other disease.
Campaigners hope the royal couple's star power will help them spread the vital message that young people's needs and fears must be addressed in the global drive to tackle HIV and AIDS. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A judge of the Supreme Court in Spain on Monday ordered six jailed Catalan politicians released, but he upheld the continued detention of two separatist activists and two other former members of the regional government, including the vice president. The judge said he believed there was no risk the defendants would leave the country, but he said it remained to be seen if their promises to respect Spanish law and renounce unilateral independence for Catalonia were truthful and real. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says his country will launch a cryptocurrency. It's a digital currency. He'll circumvent, he said, what he called a financial blockade by the U.S. government. The new currency is going to be called the Petro. It will be backed by the socialist-run OPEC nations' oil, gold, and mineral reserves. Maduro said that will let Venezuela advance toward new forms of international financing for its economic and social development. He didn't say what the new currency's value will be, how it will work, or when it will be launched. There's more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Jonathan Jones reporting from the world headquarters of the Voice of America in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December the 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Human Rights Watch accuses the DRC government of recruiting M23 rebels to squash anti-Kabila protests.
Essentially, they went to camps in neighboring countries where they recruited these fighters and told them that they should shoot at point blank any protester contesting the presidency of President Kabila.
Philip Bolopion is the Deputy Director for Global Advocacy of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. A new report says civil society groups are shrinking in the Horn of Africa. Mali postpones municipal elections due to insecurity. And Cameroon's opposition reacts to government threat to wipe out so-called secessionists.
When people go from conflict to war, they always end up on the dialogue table. So if they want to wipe out all the people causing atrocities, for me, it's not feasible. If they do, well, that is their own option.
Joseph Banazem is the minority leader in Cameroon's parliament. Burundi's government lifts a ban on a local radio station, but more media institutions remain shut down. And Sierra Leone's 709.4 carat diamond has finally been sold. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch says it stands by its report that the Democratic Republic of Congo government security recruited M23 rebels last year to crush protests against President Joseph Kabila running for another term. The report said Congolese security people and M23 fighters killed scores of people and arrested hundreds more in December 2016. The DRC government has condemned past human rights reports as an attempt to undermine the government. Philip Bolopion, the Deputy Director for Global Advocacy of Human Rights Watch, says the report's findings are based on interviews with M23 fighters and political leaders in the DRC. He says it's not unusual for the DRC government to deny Human Rights Watch reports.
What the report found is that indeed the Congolese authorities recruited M23 fighters, their former enemies, to crush dissent in the most brutal manner in the DRC in the end of last year. Essentially, they went to camps in neighboring countries where they recruited these fighters, provided them with money and food, and told them that they should shoot at point blank any protester contesting the presidency of President Kabila. And of course, we believe it's completely irresponsible for them to have done such a thing. M23 fighters are known for the serious crimes they have committed in the past in the eastern part of the country. And to seek these people and turn them against peaceful demonstrators is simply completely unacceptable.
Well, when we talk to the DRC authorities, they claim they are involved in a war against these different rebel groups. How is it possible that the government would recruit M23 fighters?
First, it's not unusual for the DRC authorities to deny the allegations that Human Rights Watch has documented in several reports. They've done so in the past. They've tried to make it very hard for Human Rights Watch to do its work in the country. And their denials are, of course, nothing new. It's true that it's surprising that they would go after, you know, people they used to fight and recruit them in this manner. At the same time, it's not completely unusual in the country. As you know, the Congolese army is partly made up of groups that used to be rebel groups fighting the government. And so, you know, even though on the face of it, it may sound surprising, the reality is that it's not all that unusual in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
When we talk to the DRC government people, they will also, each time your organization comes out with a report, they will say, you are not in the country. How dare you to publish a report about the country? How did you come to this conclusion in this particular report?
Well, look, first, we do have people on the ground that we can rely on for doing that type of research. As I mentioned, some of the fighters have been recruited in neighboring countries. So we do not make this type of allegations, accusations lightly. When we do so, it's because they have been verified. We can back them up. We have dozens and dozens of testimonies showing that this happened, showing the gravity of the human rights violations that flowed from these tactics. And so we completely stand by our report the way we've done for every previous report in the country.
So is it the view of Human Rights Watch that President Joseph Kabila should step down? Because I think I read something where it's the view of your organization that the president should step down to allow credible elections to take place. Is that correct? Which I think is at the bottom of all these protests.
We do believe that, President Kabila should follow the Constitution and stand by the agreements that were made last year and indeed relinquish power before the end of the year as agreed.
Philip, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Have a good one.
Philip Bolopion is the Deputy Director for Global Advocacy of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. He was speaking with me from New York City. A new report indicates that there is a growing mistrust between government and civil society organizations, which it says has led to the shrinking of civil society organizations in the Horn of Africa. The report by Human Rights Watchdogs, Horn of Africa Civil Society Forum, and the Human Rights Network of Uganda says African governments not only violate the rights of individuals, but also civil society groups as well. Al-Bazir Mukhtar, the chairman of the Horn of Africa Civil Society Forum, Horn of Africa, says the abuses and restrictions on NGOs indicate the level of democracy within these countries. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala, Uganda.
The report covered Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, including Somaliland, Eritrea and Ethiopia, Djibouti, Uganda, Rwanda and Kenya. While speaking at the launch of the study this Monday in Kampala, Mukhtar says governments in these countries treat NGOs suspiciously.
The relationship between CSOs and government has been characterized by, we call it, mutually assured distrust. That is, there is a distrust between governments and NGOs. For the governments, they see that CSOs or NGOs, specifically those who are speaking about human rights inside the countries, they think this is distorting the reputation of the country internationally.
He says most times these governments use repressive laws against citizens or NGOs.
One of the things that is striking, really, some of the constitutions of these countries provide, they have provisions for the protection of freedom of association and freedom of expression. But at the law, at the legal level, these the laws of these countries actually contravene the constitutions themselves.
Muhammad Ndifuna, the executive director of Uganda Human Rights Network, agrees. He says governments ought to grant NGOs with a conducive environment to operate in because they play a role in national development.
Regimes sometimes use laws as a means of self-preservation, self-protection, and sometimes that's where the contention is. There are bad laws, and those bad laws are themselves target of the work of NGOs like us.
Offices of NGO, Action Aid and Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, a policy think tank, were in September raided and closed by the government without clear justifications. Both Mukhtar and Difana say NGOs should not give up on their role of holding governments accountable, ensuring good governance, and promoting human rights. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 5th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The minority leader of Cameroon's parliament says dialogue is the best way forward to finding a solution to the ongoing Anglophone crisis. Joseph Banazem of the main opposition Social Democratic Front Party says it is regrettable that civilians are being affected by the violence which is associated with the crisis. So far, at least 8 state security operators have been killed by a group demanding independence from Cameroon. Last week, President Paul Biya warned that all necessary measures will be taken to wipe out what he said are criminals who carry out attacks against state security officers and civilians. Minority leader in Parliament Joseph Banazem tells VOA's Peter Clotty it would be erroneous for the administration to use violence to resolve the crisis.
I find it, first of all, understandable, because wiping out a people, I don't know their disposition, I don't know what they are doing, and their own activities. If you go to wipe them out, in the long run, you will run into problems of human rights abuses and so on, and brutality, force has never solved any conflict. When people go on conflict to war, and whatever thing happens, they always end up on the dialogue table. So if they want to wipe out all the people causing atrocity, for me, it's not feasible. If they do, well, that is their own option. We in the NGM, we have been clamoring for dialogue to see how to solve the problem peacefully, because we believe that peace has no price.
The president is reported to have said that the period for talks are over and that these so-called secessionists are undermining the country's stability and as such has to be dealt with in the language they best understood, to paraphrase it. How do you react to that?
We have not seen dialogue started because we in the opposition, in the SDF, we have been seeking and asking for dialogue. And in his end of year speech last year, he talked of frank dialogue. And so far, we have not had any hint of that frank dialogue. So that the time for dialogue is over, it put in question what he said and tell us that all the strategies they have been using was to exhaust people and not come up to dialogue and come up with a situation where they will now go on to eliminate the people who are causing havoc, the terrorists. And in that action, it's always the population that suffers. Women, children, old people, and even some younger ones who suffer. And we are saying that we should refrain from anything that will cause desperation and destruction and pain to our populations.
The security minister is saying that at least 8 security officers have been reportedly killed by what the government has described as these secessionists. And he said measures are being taken to wipe these criminals out and ensure peace and security are safeguarded throughout the country.
The first thing we want to say is that it is quite regrettable that soldiers have lost their lives. Now we are counting up to 8. It's very, very unfortunate. Besides soldiers, they are counting hundreds of civilians who have lost their lives, most of whom have nothing to do with the secessionists. Some of them may be, I don't know. But when you see the populations that are affected, you find out that they are innocent ones who are just caught at the crossfire.
Joseph Bana Zem is the minority leader in Cameroon's parliament. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Yaoundé. Mali's government recently announced that regional and municipal elections have been postponed from December 17 this year to April of next year. Andrew Libovich, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the continuing insecurity in Mali.
There continues to be this sort of prevailing insecurity in the country that makes it impossible on the one hand to organize something like these elections in a way that would provide an actual representation for people who are voting. As for the accords themselves, it shows how far so many elements of the accords have dragged on. I mean, there are things like the interim authorities that are supposed to be essentially transitional local authorities who would then pave the way for real local councilor elections. These authorities are not even in place, or they're in place, but they're not. They don't have the financing they need. They don't have the institutional architecture or support that they need. And those interim authorities, according to when the accords are signed, they're already supposed to have finished their mandate, and they haven't even really started to work.
Do you think that these representatives have a legitimacy problem, especially in the north?
Well, there was initially the coordination of movements for the Azawad, so the sort of vaguely pro-independence or pro-autonomy umbrella group, was opposed to these elections because of the conditions surrounding how they would be implemented and questions about whether or not they would be fully representative. These elections, in theory, would be for local representatives, but even in the past when there were local officials elected to offices such as mayor of villages or even cities, the fact that they were local representatives did not necessarily mean much in terms of whether or not they were taken seriously by local populations, or then we could say by which local populations. So I think the problem is not just one of political representativity, but actually how local communities not only get to decide policies that that they feel best favor the communities or work best for those localities, but also how they're supported financially.
What populations are people afraid that are being excluded and they want to make sure to bring them into the fold, and why?
These elections were both for local council elections and for 60 localities that couldn't be included in the last local elections because of the security situation. So I read the comments about inclusivity to be really about being able to allow a vote for as many people as possible and as many communities as possible. Now, that, of course, raises again the question of security. And if the security situation continues to get worse, then it's a bit of a joke to say that these elections somehow will be more inclusive, because if the government continues to lose its effective control in some areas, then by their very nature, they couldn't be inclusive elections because a number of people are going to be unable to vote.
That was Andrew Leibovitz, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. The Burundian government Monday lifted a suspension it imposed 3 months ago on a local radio station. But as Moses Habyarimana reports from Bujumbura, the government's clampdown on media institutions and journalists continues.
Since 2015, when the violent protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza erupted, the media houses in Burundi were negatively impacted by the crisis. At least 4 media houses were closed after failed coup. According to Journalists Without Borders, more than 50 journalists fled the country for fear of their own security after the government accused some media houses of participating in the 2015 failed coup. In October, a local radio station, CCIB, was closed by the Burundi media regulator for the reports aired in September, which the authority said was unprofessional. Divine Niyokwizigirwa is the spokesperson of the media regulatory authority.
They didn't respect the editorial line, and that was a very, very big mistake they made. But after all those analyses, we saw that maybe it wasn't the intention of the radio.
The decision to close the CCIB radio came after the news editor who fled the country in October broadcasted a story indicating Burundi government's involvement in the killing of the more than 30 Burundian refugees in Democratic Republic of Congo in September. Denis Shimrimana is the manager of the CCIB radio.
It was a problem to undertake our daily work without the radio. So what we will do is that hold a small meeting with the staff to talk with them and the conditions of reopening of the radio and how to observe the editorial line of our chamber of our radio.
Burundi government amended the 2015 media law that guaranteed the protection of sources, and the journalists were not obliged to reveal their source of information. Media organizations are subjected to be penalized if the information that is disseminated threatens their national security. Balen Havyarimana is a Burundi-based journalist. He says that the sources now fear to talk to the media.
They think after telling this to the radio, the aftermath will be a catastrophe for them. That's why they said, no, I can't talk, I can't speak. You know, the situation is very complicated. This is a situation that we face in everyday life. I mean, a good situation of security, but anything can happen at any time. This is the problem that we have in this country.
The Media Regulatory Authority terminated licenses of 3 media houses of not legalizing their registrations. That included Renaissance, African Public Radio, and Bonesha FM, among which are accused of participating in the 2015 failed coup. Though the government authorized the reopening of CCIB Radio, another local radio station, Izere FM, was closed. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Earlier this year, a pastor in Sierra Leone discovered a 709.41-carat diamond. Since then, attempts have been made to sell the gem in Belgium. The diamond, one of the 20 biggest in the world, was originally valued at over $50 million by diamond experts. But a $7.7 million bid for the gem failed to materialize last July in Freetown. Now, Abdoulaye Birete, spokesman for President Ernest Bai Koroma, says the diamond was finally sold on Monday in New York City.
Well, the good news is on Monday, of course, December 4, the Rappaport Group, which volunteered to sell the diamond on behalf of the pastor and the government because of the transparency, after a proclamation was made, the diamond being a Sierra Leone piece diamond, eventually a millionaire in New York was able to get the highest bid for the diamond at $6,536,360. We consulted with President Koroma and also with the pastor and his family who are all in New York. And eventually, we sold it to the highest bidder today.
The original price of this diamond was what? $15 million. And then it went to Europe for sale. And I think there was no buyer for $7.7 million. Did the government of Sierra Leone lose money? How did you come up to $6 million?
Well, no price tag was attached to the diamond. In fact, when it was discovered in May, we had to go into a national bidding process that attracted international bidders at the bank complex in Sierra Leone. At the time, the highest bidder was able to come up with a $7,077,777. After the diamond, the quality was determined by experts. The very person that came up with that highest bid in Freetown, this time round, only came up with $3.5 million. So eventually, the highest bidder was Lawrence Graff.
Let's talk briefly. Who benefits now from this money, this $7 million?
Well, we have a National Minerals Act of 2009, whereby the NMA Act clearly states in terms of the percentage, how much the government is going to accrue, how much the pastor is going to get, how much the community is going to get out of this diamond. But for us, though, as a government, whatever we get, we want to demonstrate to the world that this piece is really going to benefit not only the people of Koyado Village, but as well. That point was emphasized. In fact, that was why the Rappaport Group even came on board to auction this diamond for us on gratis. They said because it is a money that is going to be rolled out to the communities and will benefit the artisanal diamond miners who were usually neglected.
Abdoulaye Birete is a spokesman for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. He was speaking with me from New York City. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch says it stands by its report that the Democratic Republic of Congo's government secretly recruited M23 rebels last year to crush protests against President Joseph Kabila running for another term. The report said Congolese security people and M23 fighters killed scores of people and arrested hundreds more in December 2016. The DRC government has condemned past human rights reports as an attempt to undermine the government. And that's it for this Tuesday, December 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Jackson Vunganyi, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very lovely day.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa. African Music Mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.